And that was Azulito, performed by Wynton Marsalis and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. We'll be hearing more about them later on the program. This is Live and Local. I'm Roger Cooper, sitting in for Kevin Kelly. During the second portion of our program, we'll be listening to an interview that Kevin had with saxophonist and clarinetist Victor Goins, who is a member of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra and the Wynton Marsalis Septet, as well as Director of Jazz Studies and Professor of Music at Northwestern University. That'll be coming up, but we start by talking with Duke Bagger and Michael V. They're from the Charleston Alley Theater at 718 Monroe Street in Charleston, Illinois.
Yeah.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
The movie Miracle on 34th Street has become a seasonal classic on television, and now it has been adapted to the stage as a mock radio broadcast in the studios of WCAT. This afternoon, in the studios of WILL, we will talk with Duke and Michael about putting on this holiday treat at the Charleston Alley Theater. And I understand this is the final production of the 2013 season.
It's our last production of our 23rd continuous season. For an all-volunteer group to run 23 seasons with four original members still with it, that says a lot.
Mm-hmm. And that was Duke Bagger speaking. Michael V. is also in the studio as well. This production is based on the popular holiday film, and Duke, you're the director of it, is that?
I'm the director and then the announcer, too.
And what about who made the adaptation?
It actually is it's a free script that was Lux Radio in 1943, and we've adapted it to our own stage, where they had a lot of different advertisements for Lux products. We have sponsors in our program, and we do radio spots. We do advert spots for our sponsors, and we use words like swell and gee. Gee, wasn't that swell?
Well, golly, golly.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, this isn't the first time that you've done this, is that correct?
No, we did it 2 years ago as well, and it's a popular sort of thing that can involve a wide range of age group. Mm-hmm. To where I'm by far the oldest, but then the youngest is, I believe, 6. And she gets up to the microphone, and she's just having a wonderful time. I made mock microphones out of 2x4s and screen wire and painted them gold and little WCAT sign on the top of them. So we try to make it as abstractly correct as possible.
Well, gee, that's just super keen. And Michael, what is your part in this production?
Well, I have two or three voices that I do, reading different characters, and also the DJ. So I get to say swell a lot myself.
Okay.
We start the show with a pre-show as the audience is coming in. Mm-hmm. And so rather than just tracking music, Michael's going to be off stage like he's in Studio A, and between different cuts of 1940s music, he's going to break in with a little chatter about the next cut he's going to do. And then ultimately, he will throw Studio A to Studio B, and we go live.
So this is kind of set up kind of in the nature of our town?
Well, kind of. It's set up in the nature of what a real radio station would be like, where, you know, the studio would have an audience. There were studio audiences in the 40s for these radio dramas.
I was going to say, I haven't seen many audiences around here.
Right. No, but they would invite them there was no TV. They would come and they'd sit there and watch the live radio programs. I did that. I remember in the late 40s at WLS when they had the barn dance on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
And every once in a while, it was cheap entertainment. It was free.
Now, did you say you did it in the late 40s?
Well, I went to see it in the 40s.
So you must have been a very young kid.
Well, I was little, yeah. I held my father's hand as we walked down the streets of Chicago, yeah.
How old were you, Michael? When you first saw the original film, 1947 film.
Oh, wow. I must have been about 10 years old, mm-hmm. first time I saw it, yeah. It really sticks in your brain, you know?
Yeah.
It's a classic.
How about you?
I can't remember the first time I saw it because we got a TV in 1949, so It was probably in the early 50s sometime.
Do you remember what your first impressions were of it?
Oh, well, I cheered.
Right?
I cheered when the judge says, you know, enough of this. Yes, I rule for, there he is, Santa Claus. I went, yeah! And we moved to an apartment building that that had a fireplace in it. And my first thing was to look up the chimney to see if Santa could come down. And my father assured me Santa would be able to deal with it.
And did you see the remake then that came up? I think it was, what, 94?
No.
I don't think I have.
No. Okay. Well, that blows my next question. But the follow-up to that question, though, would have been, This production that you're doing, do you think that it makes, well, this isn't really a movie to make moral points or anything like that, but does it make more points or more poignant perhaps being on a smaller venue than the big screen?
In a way, our house is extremely small.
Mm-hmm. Very intimate.
I'm sorry, I have to be careful. I keep saying house and about. I'm supposed to say about and house.
A little bit of canon.
And our place is so intimate that as readers, we are closer to the audience than I am to you. And right now, that's about 5.5 feet.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we put the microphones right at their toes. And so there's an intimacy to it that is really endearing in that we have learned how to work with it after 23 seasons, mm-hmm. and that we play to that strong suit of that intimacy of our theater. And in its own way, it is such an uplifting story that, you know, it's not about commercialism. It's not about all these other things. It's about peace and harmony and how even sworn enemies like Macy and Gimble can get along mm-hmm. and actually have pictures taken with where they're shaking hands. That's the whole point of the season. And that kind of intimacy in our little place really plays well. Plus, of course, having children doesn't hurt.
Right?
It helps bring in grandma and grandpa and aunties and uncles and other classmates.
Well, I wonder, have you ever considered actually recording this and presenting it as a radio broadcast?
No, we're a live theater, and that's pretty much our main concern mm-hmm. is how to put live productions on stage. We're very small, but we are able to stay small. And as a result, we can do things no one else can or will.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can do the Rocky Horror Show. And when Frankenfurter is standing on your toes, it's a whole new experience. And when we do Shakespeare, which we will in our next season, we're going to be doing Taming of the Shrew. During the monologues, during the soliloquies, there's no point in just talking to the space.
Mm-hmm.
You're standing right in front of someone, so we'll sit down next to you and talk to you in the soliloquies. So we use the intimacy of the house. And we're just going, since we're all volunteer, and we also have the mortgage on the building, which means I'm also the super of a building with four apartments upstairs, we just pretty much count on going from one show to the next show to the next show and then having time in there somehow to breathe.
Mm-hmm. Do you suppose we could maybe have a sample of a little bit of the...
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and this would be a scene where Kris Kringle is in the courtroom. They've decided to have a sanity hearing for him. And one of the ways that they need hard proof that he is indeed Santa Claus. And so the postmen stop by and they pick up a letter from Doris, one of the lead characters. And it's from her daughter, Susan, who sent a letter to Santa Claus. And the postmen pick it up and now they're back in the post office. And he says, well, you know, Louis, another letter for Santa Claus. Hey, here's a new one. Instead of the North Pole, this kid's got it addressed to Kris Kringle, New York County Courthouse.
Well, the kid's right.
Yeah, sure, they got him on trial down there. He claims he's Santa Claus, and the DA claims he's nuts.
Hmm.
Hey, I got an idea.
Yeah.
How many Santa Claus letters we got down there in the dead letter office?
Oh, who knows? It must be 50,000 bags and bags all over the joint. Hey, you mean...
why not? Wouldn't it be nice to get rid of them all, wouldn't it? Boy, oh boy, look, Louie, as soon as we get to the post office, we go and see the supervisor. You know something? I bet we both get promoted.
That's terrific. That's just wonderful. I remember that scene very, very well.
And that's where they decide to take those bags and bags and bags of letters and plop them on the judge's desk. And that's when every five-year-old goes, yeah, right? Go Santa.
Wow, I'm blown away. That's just terrific.
Well, thank you.
That's wonderful. I hope we have time to do some more.
And what we love about doing a radio production is, as they did in the 40s and the 50s, the same person would do multiple characters just by changing the voice.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So as the radio announcer, I can come out and say, this is WCAT 71.8 on your dial and broadcasting live from the square just off the square mm-hmm. in Charleston, Illinois. And then, hey, I can be a postman too from New York, from the Bronx. I can do a Bronx, hey. I can also be from the north side of Chicago.
You know, I think radio drama, it was something I remember as a kid, and I think it's something that should come back. I think that...
Yeah. Well, you know, Prairie Home Companion
yeah, they do a lot
pretty much follows in that same venue. But it did leave a lot to the imagination.
Now, do you have an actual young child who does the part of... Susan is the
Susan?
Mother.
Yeah. No, she's Susan, actually playing... She's older. I would guess Haley's 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And she's playing younger than she is, but she's doing a good job. Mm-hmm. And then we have two much younger girls. One is 6, and she's just having a ball. She's just thrilled out of her mind to be part of this. And the other one is really surprising me at how well she's doing in her role. She plays the child, and it's supposed to be a boy named Mortimer. Well, we named her Madeline. Since she's a girl, there's no Mortimer here. It's a girl named Madeline. Mm-hmm. And she is really doing a beautiful job with her role. So I hope we can, you know we know we got talent like that out there, we'll look for more venues that can use people her age, because she needs more time on stage to grow. She's good.
That was my next question. How do people find your group? Do they audition? Or
we put out a cattle call through the paper and on our website. And then we have someone who does Facebook. I'm old. I do the website. That's Charleston Alley Theater with an RE.com. And it's got our entire history on it. That I do, and I figure I'm really hot stuff if I'm able to deal with that. But we put out a cattle call, and then sometimes we do a show because there are people involved that want to do that show. When we started this season, we did Mistakes Were Made, which turned out to be a one-man monologue for 90 minutes. And I wanted to do it, so we just did it. We're a small private company. We can do that. When we did Merchant of Venice, I wanted to play Shylock. So I played Shylock. I made no bones about it during the auditions. The role of Shylock's gone. Every other role is over. And then... we go from there. But by and large, it's usually through cattle calls. Mm-hmm. And then when we don't get enough, we look at the posters around the wall and say, ooh, call that person.
And tell me a little bit about the history of the Charleston company.
Our founder, Tanya Wood, she got her degree at the drama studio in New York. And she was a professional actress during the 40s until she got married. And then, like so many other women in the 40s, when she got married, she quit work and stayed as a housewife and a mother. But she was an extremely talented woman in every aspect of it.
Yes.
And she worked closely with the community theater in Charleston, and then they wanted to do shows that she didn't particularly want to do. So periodically, she owned some properties in town. She'd do a show in a storefront. And then the community theater went dark, and she called me up one day, and she said, December of 1990, she called me up and said, I want you to meet me downtown at this address. And I looked through the window of a garage door, and it used to be a Firestone tire store.
Yeah.
And she says, I bought the building. I said, well, good for you. What are you going to do with it? She said, well, I'm going to make a theater out of the tire bay here. And I said, God bless you, Tanya. Good for you. How are you going to get rid of all this junk? How are you going to make this a theater? And she said, oh, you'll figure that out. I said, what do you mean I'll figure out? How did I get in this? She said, well, I need a technical director, and you're the best there is. So we moved in January of 1991 and started turning it from a Firestone tire store into a theater while we were putting our first show on stage. Oh,
okay, that's terrific.
And then Tanya and Leonard were killed in an accident in our 2008 season, and we became a not-for-profit then. Uh-huh. And so now it's run by a board, and we are a 501c3. Uh-huh. And we just keep going from year to year, touch wood.
How many productions do you do a year?
This year we did 8, and that's so next year we're looking to do 4.
Terrific. Do you know already what they will be?
Pretty close. We're going to do something that's really new and exciting for our first production. They're going to go out to the schools and ask anybody from grade school age to adults, write whatever you want for a 5-minute script. It can be about science fiction. It can be a love story. It can be anything you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And then we'll go through the scripts and we'll put it all together in a compilation and we'll produce them.
Mm-hmm. Let's tell again, when will these performances take place now?
We open
Miracle
Friday.
Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, a Miracle on 34th Street. We open Friday at 7 o'clock is the curtain. Mm-hmm. And we'll perform again at 7 o'clock on Saturday, right after the parade around the square in Charleston. Mm-hmm. And then we'll close Sunday with a 2 o'clock matinee.
Oh, that's terrific. And other members of the cast are Diana Allen, Rachel Anderson, Craig Bonnier, Kate Borzy, Thomas McMullen, Macy Mayhall, Dorothy Mowers, Jacob Norris, Lee Pashinsky, Michael V, who is in the studio with us, Haley Walker, and Isabella Walker. Pat Shannon does sound effects. Tony Cox provides some live musical insights. And Kevin Murphy is the stage manager.
Yes.
And I thank you, Duke Bagger and Michael V, for coming in and sharing this with us here on Live and Local here on WILL.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you.
Definitely.
WILL programming is made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting the audience to enjoy the inviting musical personality of the Takashi Quartet on Thursday, December 5th at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com. I'm Roger Cooper. During the second part of the program, Kevin talks with saxophonist and clarinetist Victor Goins. He is a member of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra and the Wynton Marsalis Septet, as well as director of jazz studies and professor of music at Northwestern University. Thank you.
That's a tune called Tickle Toe, written by Lester Young for the Count Basie Orchestra, and performed here by the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis. That band is coming to the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts for a concert tomorrow night at 7:30. They're calling it Big Band Holidays, and I'm very pleased to welcome on this portion of Live and Local one of the longtime members of the band and also of the Wynton Marsalis Septet since 1993, as a matter of fact, Victor Goines. He also happens to head the Jazz Studies program at my alma mater at Northwestern University. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be on.
So what can you tell us generally about the history of the group? I guess it got started in 1988 with a pretty choice selection of musicians.
Not to say the least, that would be an understatement. You know, of course, the orchestra started as a summer concert series with the orchestra being formed with the surviving members of the Duke Ellington Orchestra, the Thad Jones Orchestra, Basie Orchestra, just some outstanding musicians like Norris Turney, Emery Thompson from New Orleans, Louisiana, Sir Roland Hannon, Britt Woodman, just a phenomenal group. And the members of Wynton Marsalis' septet at that time, Herlin Riley, Todd Williams, Wes Anderson, Eric Reed didn't play all the time because Roland Hannon was in the band, but Reginald Veal was in the band as well. So it was quite a distinguished cast of members, musicians who were in their 60s and 70s and musicians who were in their 30s. Quite a divide in terms of age, but nonetheless a great learning opportunity for some young, accomplished musicians.
Was that one of the initial points of it, to bring the older generation with the younger generation?
I can't answer that for certain. That's certainly a Wynton question, but I know Wynton is one who believes in history, and what better way to learn history than to be in an orchestra that made history with the members who made it. So I would suspect that that had some vision in it on his part, I would say.
You came in about 5 years after it got started. What was the makeup by the time you got in?
By the time I got in the band, the only member who was a member of one of those type of orchestras that was still in the band was Joe Templey, and he still is in the band. The rest of the guys had moved on. Some of them had passed away. But the makeup was Joe Templey on baritone saxophone. Walter Blandon was playing one of the tenors at that time before he left and came back into the band. Wes Anderson, myself, Bill Leasley was in the band for a while I was there at that time. And Sherman Irvin was in the band at that time as well. He left and then came back, and now he's our lead alto player. Trombone player, people like Ronald West, Trey, Wycliffe Gordon, and Wayne Goodman were in the band in the trumpet section. Wow, we know Wynton was there, Marcus Printup, Ryan Kaiser, and Roger Ingram was in the band playing lead at the time. And the rhythm section was Carlos Enriquez was there on his first joining of the band, along with Herlin Riley and Eric Reed for a while, and Fareed Barron played in it. So it was more of the, for lack of a better word, younger musicians that Wynton was associated with in the band at that time.
Yeah, that's what I kind of wondered, if the generation gap had kind of disappeared for the most part by then.
Right. Well, the gap was closing up, you might say.
The younger getting older, the older certainly not getting younger, but at least at least going elsewhere in one way or another. Does the band also bring people together from different worlds?
We do. I mean, collaboration is really important. Again, when you speak about stylistically, I suspect you're speaking about different cultures. Like we just did a concert, that was a collaboration between the musicians from Pakistan and our Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra. So we do a lot of that kind of stuff whenever possible. In fact, you know, we did things with Afro-Cuban musicians. We've done so many, it's difficult for me to pull up which ones we have done or which ones were favorites, but it's definitely a regular type of event inside of our program.
Yeah, I do want to ask you a little bit about collaborations coming up in just a bit, but I guess what I meant is whether the members of the orchestra come from different areas within jazz, or does it tend to be, you know, people tend to be, for lack of a better term, kind of mainstream jazz? Or?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm sorry I didn't get it the first time, but I
that's
got
fine.
It now. You know, we all come from our own divide of what we do. Some people focus more on bebop. Other people have whatever their experiences are. But when you get in the band, you quickly learn that for us, our philosophy at Jazz at Lincoln Center is all jazz is modern. So each time we perform a concert, it's an opportunity for us to expand our knowledge of the music. Even being from New Orleans, as I am, I had a great amount of information about New Orleans music. But being in the orchestra, it expanded my ability to be able to play the music to another level, and it gave me a better understanding of it. You have someone like Tad Nash, who's from the West Coast. One would think he knows about cool jazz more, but he knows a lot about other areas of jazz in addition to composition and arranging. Everybody has a specialty, you know. I didn't grow up in the Baptist church. Marcus Printup did. Those experiences he brings to the bandstand, obviously, is a great asset to us, and it also gives me an opportunity to learn from his tradition. So that's kind of the nature of what goes on. We all strive to be the best at all of the different genres of jazz because that's our philosophy. All jazz is modern, and we try to learn all the different areas of it through the type of programming that exists in the organization.
So it sounds like the orchestra is at some level as much an educational experience for the musicians as it is for the people you play for.
That's very true, because education is a very important part of Jazz at Lincoln Center. I mean, the number of education events we give per year far exceed the number of performances we do. But it is a learning experience for the orchestra, and that's one thing I've always admired about Winton and being able to observe what he does. He takes every performance opportunity, be it composition or performing, he takes every opportunity as a time to be able to research the history and the content of what we perform and to become better informed about it, which ultimately gives you a better chance of succeeding at what you're doing and perhaps even explain it to your audience what you're going to do. So if we do a concert, what is bebop or what is swing or who is Duke Ellington, who is Thelonious Monk? One might think we know who they are, but through the research of it, each time we do it, just being in the presence of the presentation for our audience, we walk away with some knowledge about those particular musicians or that concept or technique that we're doing. So it is a tremendous learning experience, and after being in a band for 20 years, it has become a very valuable part of my education as a jazz musician.
And I guess this would be your 20th anniversary this year. Then,
it is.
Wouldn't it? Yeah, that's a while. How much does the band come together?
We have a regular season at Jazz at Lincoln Center, which also includes three touring opportunities, one in the fall, one in the winter, one in the summer. Each year the programming varies, you know, but I think we have, it's difficult for me to tell you the numbers, we have 35 weeks of work that we actually contract for as musicians annually. And they're very creative in how they use us along the way. We have our own independent opportunities for many of the arrangers in the band, I think it's about 11 or 12 of us, to be able to be involved in preparing compositions for specific shows. We also have opportunities as individuals to be featured as in commission works. Like I have a commission work that's going to be shared on the same concert with Tad Nash in January of 14. So lots of opportunities, but and lots of regular work that the orchestra, we're a full-time orchestra.
Yeah, I sort of wondered how many of you might be doing something like what you're doing. I mean, directing an academic program at the, or at least an academic jazz program at Northwestern, and then how you juggle that, assuming there are others doing perhaps similar things, how you juggle that with a full-time gig like this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think I'm the only one in the band that actually runs one at a university, but I know there are other guys who are in charge of other programs. Like Sherman Irby is in charge of a educational program in Brooklyn, New York. I don't remember the name of it, but I remember going out to be a guest for him at one of his lectures. Other guys do different things along the way, but I'm the only one who actually runs a jazz studies program inside of a university like Northwestern. As for the term used, the juggling of it, I mean, you know, I hope I'm not juggling it because that suggests it's leaving my hand occasionally. But I'm trying to keep it rooted in my hand at all times because it's a very important thing for me. Performance and education go hand in hand. So one of these things ultimately help for me to do the other, and the other can help me be better with my students along the way. And I believe that students who are pursuing anything, not to mention the performing arts, want to and should be studying with people who are doing ultimately what they want to do. So it makes my role in the Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra that much more valuable.
You indicated that some of the educational programs, it sounded like, have themes to them, or they have thematic centers. Is that a pretty common approach for the orchestra?
Absolutely. Everything has a thematic or a theme associated with the concerts we do, be it our Jazz for Young People's Concert. I mentioned a couple of those titles along the way, or be it our concerts, even our tours. You know, we had sometimes we'll tour and do the music of Duke Ellington. Another time it might be the swing era. It might be this or that, where there's multiple composers involved, or sometimes just one, as in Duke I mentioned. But it's always a theme involved. We're very specific about what we're doing. It's not that we couldn't just do a concert that involved us playing a lot of different music. We're very, I modestly try to state the fact that we're very proficient at being able to do that. Or I should say humbly, I try to say that we're very proficient to be able to do that. But in most cases, we have a focus on what we're trying to do each time.
My guest is Victor Goins, member of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis. They're coming to Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts tomorrow night at 7:30. Here they are in a tune, actually a combination of tunes, called Kinda Dukish and Rockin' in Rhythm. That's the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis playing a short medley of two tunes, Kinda Dukish and Rockin' in Rhythm. They'll be in Bloomington tomorrow night at 7:30. And my guest this portion of Live and Local is a longtime member of the group, Victor Goines. You did mention collaborations earlier. How often do you get with symphony orchestras, and what sort of things do you do when that happens? Because you played with some pretty major ones.
We've been fortunate, and you're right. We've played with some major orchestras and some major conductors, you know, Slatkin, Mazur, Seiji Ozawa. Sometimes I have to pinch myself to say, wow, man, okay, we're playing with the Berlin Philharmonic, the St. Petersburg Symphony, the New York Phil, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Atlanta Symphony. You know, all of these great orchestras, and be around, for me, some of the most fantastic clarinetists in the world, Larry Combs, Stanley Drucker, Ricardo Morales. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's a very common part of what we did and what we do. The first concert that I remember doing a collaboration was with the New York Philharmonic, and I think it was, I'm just speculating now, but I think it was an opportunity for Wynton to become more familiar with the orchestra, and it was a matter of some Ellington arrangements he did. Of what was the suite called Harlem that Duke had written years ago, and he orchestrated it for the Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra and the New York Philharmonic. And also, one half of that concert was a contrast and comparison of, I think it might have been Duke Ellington's Nutcracker Suite that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I should say Duke Ellington's version of the Tchaikovsky Nutcracker Suite, but it was his arrangements along with Billy Strayhorn. Then, the first thing we did that really involved the orchestra was All Rise, and that was for a full choir, jazz orchestra, and orchestra. It was a major endeavor on Wynton's part, quite successful. Since then, he's written a swing symphony that involved the jazz orchestra and classical orchestra. He's written a blues symphony, which was just for classical orchestra. And I think he has some other ideas that he's considering along the way as I've had conversations, because I'm always interested to see what he has in store next for his own personal type of agenda, what he sees. For himself as a musician and composer.
Well, and of course, speaking of things that are next on the agenda, the Jazz and Lincoln Center Orchestra is playing in Bloomington tomorrow night, and the program called Big Band Holidays. So tell us about what's going to happen tomorrow.
Well, first of all, we're hoping it's going to be swinging, and we know it's going to be swinging. We're going to do our best.
I have no doubt about that, yeah.
We're going to be joined by a fabulous vocalist named Cecile McClure-Salvant. She's a fantastic young vocalist, lives in New York now, but she has really been paving the way for herself, and it's always been a pleasure to work with her, and she sounds fantastic. On the program are going to be a number of songs that people will be familiar with, maybe a couple that they won't be, but songs just as The Christmas Song by Mel Torme, that's an arrangement by Tad Nash. All of the members have contributed arrangements along the way. Chris Crenshaw, we have his arrangement of God Rest You Merry Gentlemen up there. I have a couple of arrangements of it on the program myself. Walter Blanding has something that might be considered. Rich DeRosa, who's a fantastic writer and teaches at North Texas State. Sherman Irby has something that's a possibility. So it's a bunch of holiday classics and favorites, and most of them will be arranged by members of the jazz orchestra. But then we also have some classics in the form of Jingle Bells by Ernie Wilkins, Holiday Mama by Tito Puente, Good Morning Blues, and I want to see how Wynton's going to put that into the holiday part of it when he announces it, by Eddie Durham. But you get the idea. It's going to be a lot of holiday favorites.
So when you say you want to see how he's going to do it, that implies that this is a tour that, at least as we're speaking, hasn't quite got underway yet.
Well, it hasn't started yet, but he has a certain narrative he likes to put together for the concert. And it's improvised, and it's kind of telling a story. And sometimes it's more successful than others, so it always keeps the band interested as well as the audience. And that's what I mean by it. I want to see how he's going to introduce it to make Good Morning Blues sound as holiday as God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen.
Well, since, of course, these are very familiar tunes, at least the ones that you have mentioned, but it is a jazz group, that means you're not just going to hear the tune. You're going to hear all kinds of things going on around it, both in the arrangement, but also especially in the improvisation that the band
does. Absolutely. Yeah, there'll be a lot of improvisation taking place inside of all of the music you hear here. We always leave space for members of the band to solo along the way. And with Cecile there, it adds another voice to the instrumentation and orchestration. So it's just going to expand our color palette for what we can do for the evening.
And might as well mention she's a young musician, about 23.
About that, yeah.
And won the 2010 Thelonious Monk competition.
So, absolutely.
She's got a nice little pedigree. And, of course, adding this to her resume, Wynton had to have put her up there only if he was pretty secure in her accomplishments.
Yeah, she's performed with the band several times now. Mm-hmm. She's quite comfortable in front of us, and we're comfortable with her being there. So, you know, it's really just a joining of another talented musician to the orchestra.
Well, it's a great privilege to talk to you. Victor Goines is, actually failed to mention this at the beginning, plays a bunch of instruments in the band, tenor and soprano saxes, B-flat clarinet, bass clarinet, and teaches at Northwestern University, leads the jazz studies program there, and formerly did the same for the Juilliard School and taught sax and clarinet. And it's the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis, Big Band Holidays program at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Tomorrow night at 7:30. For more information on the orchestra, go to jazzatlincolncenter.org. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you, Kevin. We look forward to seeing you and all of your audience at the concert.
Here's the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis in their quite Dixieland rendition of O Christmas Tree. Thank you.
Wynton Marsalis performing with the Lincoln Center Jazz Band, the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, in this performance of Old Christmas Trees, sort of in a Dixieland flavor of this holiday classic. And we heard that right after we heard a conversation between Kevin Kelly and Victor Goins, clarinetist and saxophonist, who will be performing with a big band holiday tune, and that's tomorrow evening in Bloomington with the Lincoln Center Orchestra. I'm Roger Cooper sitting in for Kevin Kelly this afternoon on Live and Local here on WILL. Tonight's forecast calls for cloudy skies. We'll have isolated showers and colder temperatures, low around 32. Winds out of the west at 15 to 20 miles an hour. The chance of precipitation is 20%. Cloudy tomorrow with a 40% chance of snow in the late afternoon. The high expected to be at 35 with northwesterly winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. And then Friday, cloudy with a 50% chance of snow. Highs in the mid-20s, winds out of the north at 10 to 15 miles an hour. 60 degrees at 4:55. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled On the Road Again, Cruisin' Coast to Coast with America's Music. More information at sousaarchives.org. Anitra's Dance from Peer Gynt by Edvard Grieg. We heard the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis in that performance. I'm Roger Cooper. Thank you for sharing your afternoon with us here at WILL-FM. Tonight's evening concert features the San Francisco Symphony. Michael Tilson Thomas will be conducting, and he'll have a soloist pianist, Yuja Wang, performing the Third Piano Concerto by Sergei Rachmaninoff. Also on the program, the Pavane by Gabriel Fauré, and the Symphony No. 3 by Jean Sibelius. That's tonight's evening concert here on WILL. Tonight's forecast calls for cloudy skies with isolated showers this evening. It will be colder. The low around 32, winds out of the west at 15 to 20 miles an hour. The chance of precipitation is 20%. Cloudy tomorrow, a 40% chance of snow in the late afternoon. The high is expected to be around 35. And then a 50% chance of snow on Friday with highs in the mid-20s. 60 degrees at present here on the campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Roger Cooper. Thank you for tuning in this afternoon for Live and Local here on WILL. You're listening to 90.9 WILL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR, and classical music for Central Illinois.